everyone, and welcome to the Internet Storm Center podcast. I'm your host, Joel Essler of joelessler.net, and with me is my co-host, as always, Johannes Ulrich of SAN. Say hello.
Yeah, hi, Joel. Thanks for having me again, and nice to have this podcast again after a while.
So sorry for the long hiatus. Yes. We, like I said, the last podcast, we've been traveling a bunch in between the two of us, and we're going to be a little bit more dedicated into getting these shows out in a more regular basis now. We have a few ideas on how we can kind of ramp these up a little bit. And matter of fact, one of those ideas we've been ramping up for the past week. Right, Johannes?
Right. We actually now publish the SANS Fire Talk. So I think you pushed...
Yeah, I've been pushing two of them live each day, except for the panel talk that we put out, and simply because that one was... about 80 megabytes in size, is about an hour and a half long. So I decided just to do one that day. So we didn't overload the server or anything like that. But so far, the response to those has been pretty overwhelming. I mean, we've had a lot of feedback via the web interface and via the, Twitter and things like that about people being excited about the podcast, and thousands and thousands and thousands of downloads on each one of these. So we're pretty excited about these. So we have a few ideas about how we're going to kind of keep that ball rolling as far as putting out information via the podcast and things like that, and also using, recording our podcast a little bit more often, just keeping people interested in what's going on as far as the Internet Storm Center is concerned, and seeing if we can't get some more audio from some more speeches from various conferences that go on, see if we can put those out as well. Johannes, as I mentioned, the speeches that we're putting out via the podcast are from the SANS Fire Conference that we recently held, sponsored by the Internet Storm Center there in Baltimore, Maryland. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I think it was a great conference. We had not the usual SANS evening talks, but really most of the talks were given by our IAC handlers. We also took some effort to try to stream these talks live, which is something we're playing with. Some of it worked better than others. We had one of our handlers, Boyan, who actually joined remotely. I think actually the people that listened to this section of the conference via the Illuminate system got a pretty good quality. It didn't quite work that well in the classroom itself. But his talk actually was, I think, one of the more interesting ones we had, because he talked about the passive DNS system he built. Jim Glossing was talking about analyzing malware with some open source tool, which I think was very interesting. What Jim did is he automated a lot of these sort of mundane tasks of malware analysis, like starting it up, running it for a while, collecting registry changes. He's actually now sort of maintaining somewhat and extending the Truman framework that was originally written by Joe Stewart. So I think quite a number of good talks. Any talks you remember other than the ones I mentioned?
I've been listening to the talks as I've been kind of putting them out and kind of editing the audio a little bit to clean it up. And, a lot of the audio we could have probably done a better job recording it. But, you got to do what you can when you're dealing with a live room and with a live mic and things like that. So, we do what we can. But I enjoyed the podcast's... the speeches a lot. And I actually, there was a couple that I liked. I liked Jim's that I listened to. And as you said, I actually listened to Deb's as well. That was on the first day. That was a pretty good talk as well about Iowa.
Yeah, I actually missed that one live, so I didn't get to see that one.
That was a pretty good one. I liked that one. But the... But by the time you hear this podcast, I should be putting this one out on Thursday. All of the speeches from SANS Fire have went out, and so you can go back in our archives on iTunes or in our XML link, and you can go ahead and download
those. I'll also change the podcast page probably later today, so by the time you listen to this, it should already be changed, where these monthly or less regular podcasts are featured a little bit more prominently. Right now, they're sort of pushed to the bottom below all the daily podcasts, which we still do. So that should change a little bit around. So it'll be easier to find them.
Yeah. Johannes and I had a conversation earlier this week about what we can do to interest more people and people get more value out of the podcast. So we'll be rolling out some ideas as we kind of get the chance to do it. So it would be interesting. So let's go ahead and dive right into our topics. See, our first topic that I had to review was obviously the SANS Fire Conference, which we talked about a little bit. But let's go ahead and talk about Firefox.
Yeah, Firefox today came out with version 3.5, a new major milestone for Firefox.
That's right. I've been using 3.5, just kind of the beta version, for a while now. But, you know, pretty stable. I haven't had any problems with it. Obviously, my plugins aren't updated yet, so, you know, we'll wait on that a little bit. But let's talk about some of the new security-related features of Firefox 3.5.
Well, there are a couple of issues with 3.5. First of all, it has a private browsing mode, which essentially suppresses some of the cookies and safe usernames and passwords and things like that. So sounds very similar to what Internet Explorer did on that front. Or did you see anything different, anything major different with Firefox?
Yeah, we'll have to see how that privacy system works within Firefox. I know how it works. Safari had it in on a Mac OS X, and for Windows, Safari had the privacy feature, which was part of WebKit. So if you've been using WebKit, and then thusly, I think Chrome has it as well, because Chrome uses the WebKit engine. So I think Chrome has it as well. And then IE8, like you said, that had it. And then so we'll have to see how Firefox kind of, you know, how that system works. As far as I know, you know, it doesn't save the cookies, doesn't save usernames, passwords, doesn't save history, doesn't save anything in the cache and things like that. A lot of people have started calling it porn mode. So
yeah, that's probably what it's sort of being used for. I don't really think it does a lot with respect to protecting your privacy against other websites. The one thing I can think of is that it doesn't maintain the list of URLs that you visited, so other websites don't know what URLs you visited.
Right.
But beyond that, it's really more of a mode to protect you from leaving traces on the system you're using, I think.
Yeah, which is a good feature. It could be a good feature and a bad feature, so we'll see how that works out on the forensic side.
I think there's still enough forensic evidence probably to look at, so don't trust it too much.
Yeah. Let's see, what other issues do we have here as far as security? Oh, the location-aware browsing. So what this is from what I understand, this is a geolocation API that Firefox now supports that gives the ability for Firefox 3.5 to actually know where you're at based upon Wi-Fi information using the Google location services. So if you're familiar with how iPhone version 1 was kind of a bad example because it doesn't use Google location services, but kind of the same principle, right? So it allows you to kind of figure out where you're at based upon the access points that you're around.
I think the iPod Touch actually uses the same system. I don't know if they use the same database, but it also uses the Wi-Fi access points in your area. And now you do have to allow websites to access that data. So what you should see is whenever you visit a website that would like to access your location data, you should see a pop-up, and then you'll be able to grant access to that website. However, Firefox will remember that information. So you come back to the same website, it will again have access to your location. Now, don't mix that up with sort of the traditional way location is done on the web, which just uses some databases that maps your IP address to a location. This will actually look at your wireless card, see what access point are you connected to, and then use this database. There's a company that basically drives around the country and warp drives and enumerates all the access points that it can find. And then based on the BSSID, actually, not the SSID, just off your access point, it will try to figure out where you're located.
Right. I'm not sure if Apple uses the same one that Google does. I wouldn't be surprised if they do. But knowing Google, I'm not, you know, not sure how they do the geolocation services for the Wi-Fi stuff. But you hit it right on the nail right on the head. Is basically it's kind of the same way as the version one of the iPhone. It's not as specific as GPS, but it's a lot more specific than, you know, IP reverse lookup type of location features. So just something to be aware of. I'm not sure. I haven't really reviewed Firefox 3.5 to see if there's a way easily to disable it. I know for, you know, maybe our government listeners, they want to know how to turn that off. on the browser itself. So I haven't really looked into how to turn it off within Firefox 3.5, but you know, that's something that our listeners may be aware of.
So. Yeah, it's actually not that easy to disable. What you have to do in Firefox 3.5 is there is no simple setting for it. You have to enter the about:config URL in the browser, which gives you all kinds of warnings that you're now voiding your warranty and whatever. And then you have to look for geo.enabled and turn that off. So it's a little bit hard, I would say, to disable it. I don't know, you know, if you can do it with group policy or whatever. Probably there is a way to do that or script it. You know, that's if you're interested in doing it sort of enterprise-wide.
I wonder if, is it on or off by default? Did you check?
I haven't checked yet, but I believe in the beta at least was on by default. So it should be on. Yeah. Actually, there's one more issue I want to point out, and that's XML HTTP request, my old favorite JavaScript function. Because Firefox 3.5 implements the level 2 specification of XML HTTP request, which does allow cross-domain requests. So same origin policy does no longer apply straightforward to the XML HTTP request function. Actually, the XML HTTP request function works a lot like the cross-domain request in Explorer 8. There are restrictions on how it can be exactly used. Jason Lamb and myself, we wrote a little paper up about that and also set up a test page on the ISC website where you can just point your browser to it and it will tell you what things you can and cannot do. So it runs through all the possible header combinations and such, and basically tells you what worked, what didn't work. That paper, again, I should probably publish the URL as a link again on the ISC site, or maybe you can do that with the podcast. But that paper sort of gives you a little run-through on it. It's not as simple. It's actually quite complex in how this works.
Another thing I actually just noticed was DNS prefetching, which could be interesting if you think about things like, you know, maybe some DNS attacks that have been out there recently. But so what DNS prefetching is that when you go to a website, what Firefox 3.5 will do is it will look at all the links on the website, and if they're, you know, and it will prefetch all the DNS, it will do the DNS requests in the background. Firefox does this. If you do this to Google, if you like, for instance, if you were to Google something within Firefox and you, it sends you to Google, I think Google actually prefetches the first link within Google. I think it does that automatically. But this takes it a step further and does DNS requests. So what that does is, like I said, any link that's on a particular website, Google will, or Firefox will prefetch all the domain names within it. And then that way, when you actually go to click on a link within a web page, it will just basically go to it faster. So it doesn't have to do the DNS lookup. Very small, you know, time savings and kind of resource savings there, but something that you know, kind of an interesting thought when you think about attack vectors.
Yeah. I'm just sort of thinking out loud here, but I could think that first of all, you now have more DNS queries being asked by your web browser, so that could set off some anomaly detection there, or just hit not too much load on the DNS server. My sort of random guess would be it's probably a factor of 2, maybe even 10, if you think about all the links. The other thing, if you're doing policy enforcement and malware detection by looking at what URLs people are accessing. So now somebody may not actually go to a porn page. They may just hit a page that links to a porn page. And the DNS behavior will look like they went to the page. So there are a couple issues I can think of right now where you may see this as odd behavior.
Yeah, so there is actually ways to disable this on the server side. So, for instance, you know, you're running a web server and you do not want the browser coming to you to do the DNS prefetching. You can actually turn that off, and there's actually instructions for that on the Mozilla website. So it's just something to keep in mind. Just thought we'd cover that right quick. The next thing we have on the list is the Mozilla content security policy to mitigate XSS.
Yes, that's actually an interesting topic. I just sort of did a little bit research into that. I haven't really fully explored it yet. It's sort of an interesting concept, but it's not yet really implemented in Firefox 3.5. I thought it would come out with Firefox 3.5, but appears that it will wait till 3.6. Now, the goal of these content security policies is to mitigate cross-site scripting. How well it can do that, well, that's still a little bit controversial. But you know, as all of these policies, I see it as a meaningful additional layer. It doesn't really prevent cross-site scripting. It just makes exploitation of cross-site scripting harder. The idea is that within the headers of your site, you can specify what kind of JavaScript functions and JavaScript you're allowing. So, for example, you can tell the browser, this page uses no embedded JavaScript. All the JavaScript that comes, that is used in this page, is included via files that are loaded, so via JavaScript include files. And those files have to come from specific hosts. So a simple solution here would be to essentially eliminate cross-site scripting. You remove all the JavaScript from your pages, move them into these JavaScript include files, and then tell Firefox, well, only include JavaScript files from my own site. And that sounds like it will eliminate cross-site scripting. Now, problems with that are, first of all, what if somebody doesn't use Firefox 3.6 once it comes out, or another browser that complies with content security policies? They would still be vulnerable. You can also limit, like for example, you can eliminate eval. You cannot allow the eval JavaScript function. But there are other JavaScript functions that allow like callbacks that sort of do the same thing. So it's there's some holes in that policy, but I see it as a meaningful sort of additional layer. If you code a new website now, you probably should read up on these content security policies, see how they apply to a website, and use them. You know, nobody will really bother to check them yet. They will not break old browsers, but you probably should already start coding around content security policy or CSP. So once these new browsers come out, they'll take advantage of it.
That's good that it's good that Mozilla's taking those proactive steps or reactive steps, however you kind of want to look at it. But it's good that there's actually a movement being made in that area. So
they're in the work for quite a while, and they're somewhat controversial because you know, they're not perfect. There are holes in it, like I mentioned, these callback functions and things like that. But it sounds like a meaningful protection, and it's simple enough to implement. They're really in particular for a new project, you probably want to be aware of that and build that into a new project. Retrofitting old sites, of course, now that depends on how messy they are in the first place.
Right. Just as long as they are, you know, IE7 compliant, right?
Yeah.
I saw an article on the internet earlier today that it was actually Microsoft's website. It was an MSN.com website, and if you browse to it using IE6, it was horrible. It looked all over the place because it was coded for, I think, IE7 or IE8, and IE6 was so broken. It was kind of funny.
Yeah, why don't we talk about this now? Like, one thing we're also looking for is feedback about DShield, Internet Storms, and how can we make it better? And I spent some time the last couple of weeks of looking at different advances in browsers and how we may want to, take over some of that. We do use style sheets already for a few years now pretty extensively. But, all that stuff that's not possible with JavaScript, with XHTML, DHTML, so all these extensions that just make it look better to some extent, but also allow for better, more dynamic functionality. If anybody has any feedback for that, please let us know. What would you like to see? What would you not like to see? The big decision I have to make is whether or not I use JavaScript for some of these features. Right now, the Internet Storm Center site is designed that it will work without JavaScript. All the features should work without JavaScript. The one thing that doesn't really work is some of the layout stuff, and so uses JavaScript. It may look slightly different. Like you may not see some of the hover issues and things like that. But overall, it should work with JavaScript right now. I'm thinking about giving up on that because there's really so much neat stuff you can do with JavaScript. And I find myself, I use NoScript, but I turn it off so many times. It's just, it's getting really, really hard to browse without JavaScript. And so I'm not sure how much sense it makes for Storm Center to sort of stay behind the times there.
Yeah, it's I tend to use NoScript a lot on my Firefox installation as well. So we'll see. I think the way NoScript actually works is it says, you know, hey, we allow Java, but then when it comes to the browser side, it actually gets disabled. So next topic we have on the list here is the web honeypot logs are actually coming online.
Yeah, I'm working on that today, and if you go to isc.sans.org/weblogs, that's off the index page to the web honeypot. You already should see the top 10 attacks that we see. Well, right now, actually, I may go there right now this moment and see if it's actually still working. It should have been updated by now. These logs update once an hour. So once an hour, basically, I compile a new summary that's then being displayed on the site. And we do have about 20 submitters so far. It's still in beta. But if you're interested, you can download it. Just go to the MyISC page and log in. You have to log in. You have to have an account at this point to submit logs. You can download it from the My Information page. It's of a TGC file. It includes instructions on how to install it. You do need PHP, but you do not need a dedicated IP address for it. You can set it up as a name virtual host. Just an IP address, of course, that's available from the outside. Like, you know, your internal web server is probably not getting to give us much logs. And your web server has to be able to report logs to us. So about 20 submitters now. The top 10 attacks. Oh, there's a new one in the top 10 attacks, actually, that I haven't seen on before. But a lot of them I still have to clean up. For example, our top 2 attacks, top 1, biggest one is no match. Basically, we haven't classified those URLs yet. Then get slash. If somebody's just going to the index page, not really sure if that is an attack or not. Now, robots.txt is number 3, and you know, these may just be search engines here. But what we found so far is that a lot of the attacks are remote file inclusion. And if I look at it here, basically all of the top 10 that are specific attacks are remote file inclusion. So directory traversal attempt, have to see where this exactly fits in, but it's just two authors reporting on that right now. So I hope to get crafts and such online later today. We'll see how much I get done. We also link here to CVE entries and the open software vulnerability database and things. We can learn more about these particular vulnerabilities.
Yeah, so it would be obviously beneficial if we had a lot more submitters for that, so we can kind of, it's kind of the same concept as DShield, yep, except just in the web application realm.
Yeah, I'm hoping for like 100 within a year once we actually make it finalized. Now, the beta version right now, it's really close to final. I don't think we're really going to add any significant features to it. And this beta version that's out now comes with an auto-update script. So if you install it, it should be able to pull down additional logs. Really, what we need right now most is people to download that beta version, install it, and give us feedback on what works, what doesn't work.
Excellent. So let's go ahead and take a look at that. You can find that at isc.sans.org/weblogs, weblogs. So our next topic we have here is what we're affectionately calling the death spam. And this is something that kind of happens every time somebody dies. But this past week, we had a couple big ones.
Michael Jackson, Billy Mays.
Rest in peace for that. But Michael Jackson died suddenly, and Farrah Fawcett died, and Ed McMahon, and Billy Mays, actually. Four. We had so we put out an article late last week, as soon as kind of about a couple hours after we found out that Michael Jackson had passed away, about maybe kind of warning people that that, you know, possibly people kind of jumping on the bandwagon as far as trying to send out some spam. And I don't know, a couple hours later, not even that, I don't think, we started to get our first reports of Michael Jackson death spam is what we're calling it. And so it's kind of unfortunate that people kind of jump on that train or that bandwagon. But that's something to be aware of whenever something very public happens, you know, hurricanes, you know, celebrities dying. You know, I'm trying to think of some other big examples that have happened recently, things like, you know, earthquakes and floods, things like that. Everybody kind of jumps on that bandwagon, whatever's the biggest thing in the news right that very minute. These spammers love to take advantage of it. So that's something to be aware of.
Yeah, one of the big ones was probably the storm warm a couple of years ago that got its name from sort of its initial spam was about some big storms in Europe that it used to spread itself. It promised some videos about that. And ever since then, actually that particular piece of malware sort of kept mutating with different public events. Now, we typically also see some domain name registrations that go along with that, in particular with the hurricanes. We have seen it a lot. Don't see it that much with the celebrities because most of the domain names that relate to these celebrities are already registered for a while because they already attract some hits. So you have them just the usual Google Ads stuff that's being sort of put on these pages.
Well, it's especially like in the case of Michael Jackson with the gigantic celebrity that he was, you know, pretty much every website you could think of with, you know, his names of his songs and dance moves that he did and a lot of things like that, his name and alternate spellings of his name. A lot of those things are already taken for years now, just based upon the fact that Michael Jackson was such a big celebrity as he was. So. Soliciting feedback about the Internet Storm Center and DShield. I know we touched on this a little bit earlier in the podcast, but I figured we'd go ahead and kind of touch on it again. Looking for some feedback on how to make the Internet Storm Center more useful. And we've had a lot of feedback about kind of layout and, you know, things to kind of pretty the front page of the website up. About, you know, kind of moving some tables around and moving blocks around, things like that. And what we'll do as far as that, you know, we've taken a lot of that stuff into consideration, and we're going to be acting upon a lot of that. But Johannes, you want to talk about some other kind of information that you'd like to see submitted as far as the Internet Storm Center?
Yeah, really what I'm looking for is what would it take to make the Internet Storm Center sort of your homepage? And my vision is really to make it a little bit more like a dashboard. It really shows you more what's going on these days on the internet. Also allow you to include stuff from other sites, not just from our own site. So sort of take a little bit that portal idea further. The diary should still be the main feature on the page. I think that's, you know, what most people are come to us for. But you know, there's lots of other data around that it's interesting and that should probably be included in some ways.
Right. I think it would be we also want to make it – I know Johannes and I, you and I had some conversation about this recently about how to make it more accessible via – mobile platforms as well, since things like Android and things like the iPhone have really taken off as far as mobile browsing platforms. We really want to make the Internet Storm Center a lot more easily navigable via those that means and faster to be able to download things like that. So we're working on a couple different methods for that.
Yeah, for the iPhone, you should already see a slightly modified layout. Whereas of the right bar is missing, you basically just have the diaries there. I'm thinking about, you know, having like a dedicated mobile site, something like mobile.dshield.org or something along these lines. Have to see how that'll work out exactly.
Yeah, maybe we make it, you know, m.dshield.org or something.
Yeah, that
something
seems
very
something
small,
that's very
something
common,
very
yeah.
easy. Mm-hmm. Yeah, something easy that people can type in very easily on the go. So I think that'll be excellent. So what we want you to do is we want you to submit some feedback about that via our contact link. If you go to isc.sans.org at the very top in the blue bar, you'll see a link that says contact. And what we'd like for you to do is go ahead and click on that link and submit some feedback about what you'd like to see as far as the homepage on the Internet Storm Center and dshield.org to kind of make that, you know, your heads-up display a little bit more useful. And the last thing we have here as far as topics are concerned is We want to talk about Twitter and URL shortening. Now, obviously the Internet Storm Center has, a Twitter account and things like that. We've been kind of pushing that publicly just to kind of give people a special method of contacting us via Twitter and getting the information disseminated that to our users and our readers quickly. But we want to talk about URL shortening a little bit.
Yeah, like a couple of things that sort of came up with URL shortening and Twitter. First of all, the entire issue of obfuscating malicious URLs. A lot of the content filters that we're using, like for spam filters and such, they usually look for known malicious URLs. And of course, they fail when it comes to these URL shorteners because, well, now every URL is tinyurl.com. The other problem with Twitter in general is, how do you know that whoever claims to be Sans ISC is actually Sans ISC? I think we got that problem. Twitter is like ISC underscore Sans.
Yeah, the official account for Twitter is Sans underscore ISC. But there's also another one that is something like ISC Sans or something like that. And so that's something to keep in mind.
It's probably best if you continually follow a particular account, then you sort of know based on the history to trust it. Then, of course, some of the well-known Twitter accounts have been taken over by spammers, for example, that then use these Twitter accounts to push malware.
That's right. And hopefully whoever set up the other account that's out there doesn't intend to use it for anything malicious. Luckily, the account that we're using was handed over to us by a reader, which was actually a nice thing for them to do. So, that's something to keep in mind. Pay attention to who you're following. Pay attention to the URLs that are put up on those. We use the dig.com shortening service. Purely for the reason that, if people want to go ahead and submit that URL to Dig, it's a lot easier for them to do it based right there in the title bar, and they can do that type of thing. So we've kind of moved to the dig.com shortening service purely for that reason. And so you know whether or not, the links are from us or not.
Most of these URL shorteners do allow you to set up some kind of a preview cookie or whatever, which will first show you the URL before it actually redirects you to it. I don't think it's that big of a deal, like from a user interface perspective, because most of the time I really don't know what the link is I'm clicking on, even if it's already expanded. Now, unless it's a well-known site, there's so many links that we click on, every day. I don't think you really validate every single link that you click
on. Right,
and
it's something to keep in mind as far as browser security is concerned is, when you have something like these URL shorteners, it becomes increasingly important as far as, your client-side security and patching and things like that. So, here's our monthly reminder to make sure that you keep your browsers and all your client-side applications patched against those attack vectors. I don't know, Johannes, is that all we have for this week?
I think that's all we have for this week, yeah.
Excellent. So just to keep in mind, we have the daily Internet Storm Center, or the Stormcast as we're calling it. That's recorded by Johannes primarily, but a couple other people have chimed in as well. So what we want to do is we want to make sure that we, post the fact that we have the Stormcast. We want to get a lot of subscribers to that as well, because that gives you a daily audio version and kind of commentary of the previous day or that day's events as far as the Internet Storm Center is concerned and things that have been reported to us. So make sure that you subscribe to that as well. You can get to both of the podcasts by going to isc.sans.org/podcasts.html. So excellent. So again, we'll see you next time. And like I said, we're going to try and keep these a little bit more regular, and we'll see how that promise lives up to go. But thank you for tuning in, and we appreciate it.
Thanks, everybody.